Thank you everyone, thank you very much indeed, and a very warm welcome from the Royal Institute of British Architects in London, where we are about to meet the creator of the Aquatic Centre for the 2012 London Olympics, the Cincinnati Museum of Modern Art, and the extraordinary Guangzhou Opera House, to name only a few. Our guest is the only architect to have won our host's architecture prize, the Stirling Prize, 2 years in succession, and this is really giving the game away in such a male-dominated profession, the first woman to have ever won the Pritzker Prize, architecture's equivalent of the Nobel. Since she won that award, she has embarked on an amazing period of creativity, whether it's schools, science centres, office buildings or factories. It seems the whole world wants one of her complex, avant-garde, landscape-defining buildings. Her practice has expanded to deliver projects in Singapore, Salerno, Moscow, Montpellier, Abu Dhabi, Azerbaijan and many other places besides. All this from someone who, for much of her career, was described as a paper architect, someone whose beautiful designs and challenging ideas were thought to be all but unbuildable. She was born in Iraq and has made her home here in London. Please welcome the inimitable Zaha Hadid. Zaha, I want to start by talking to you about one of your most recent buildings, the Guangzhou Opera House. It's in the city once called Canton and will have special resonance, I think, for you for reasons we shall come to later in the interview. It lies low against the Pearl Harbor River with towers behind it and a huge asymmetric 1,800-seater theatre, which is curvy and moulded. I think almost grotto-like. How would you describe it?
Well, I mean, the space inside is kind of like a, well, like an oyster or like a grotto, but more like an oyster, maybe. And the asymmetry, we didn't test it fully in Cardiff, but the idea of asymmetry, the idea was to intensify the sound or make the sound more interesting.
The exterior and the interior are fluid. It's a hallmark of your work, and it certainly reminds me of water and rivers. How much inspiration do you draw from the landscape around? How much is the landscape and the context that you're building in important?
Well, it's not necessarily always drawn in from the landscape around it. I mean, I think that context could be also things which are juxtaposed, or there are lines which you draw out from the existing site. And I believe that you have to do two things at the same time. You have to observe and create simultaneously. So you acquire some knowledge, whether from the site or the subject matter. So you have contextuality, the context of other concert halls or other operas or other projects feeding into this one particular project.
Well, let me just expand that whole notion of contextuality. Let's talk about the London Aquatic Centre, which for many people, lots of people have tried to describe it. They've talked about it as a whale, a dolphin, a wave. It's not hard to see that something like the Zaragoza Bridge in Spain also has aquatic elements. But it never strikes me that it's ever mimicry. How do you avoid mimicking a thing that we know
if I wasn't trained as an architect and I want to do something looking like sea life, if I was doing a fashion show and I wanted to do a sort of a Zaha project, I will do literally some seashells. But I think that you have to understand that the repertoire has been developed over many years. Although we use these terms, oh, it's like sea life, but it's not literally the same as these things. They're not literal translations. Your palette, let's say, has expanded, and it involves, and because of complexity and the whole idea of fluidity, the repertoire is larger, so you can take in other components.
Your buildings are very unlike other buildings, but they're actually quite wildly different from each other as well. I want to ask you about the same concepts underlying the designs of the building. Just talk me through the concepts that underlie your practice.
Well, I don't think there is a kind of single idea. I think for the first 20 years, we tried to invent everything every time. But it was very much based on abstraction.
What do you mean by that? When you talk about abstraction, what do you mean?
Well, it's not literally a mountain. It's inspired by a mountain or a hill. So if you talk about a building as a hill, or a building as a shell, or a building as a rock, they're not really literally a rock. They are, in terms of the way they meet the ground, so they're various things. So the way they meet the ground, they are seamless. It's not. There isn't a kind of a break. It's not dealing with one kind of geometry, but many other geometries. And also it implied that the interiors are also have a degree of fluidity.
The obvious geometry that is not present in your buildings is the right angle. So what have you got against the right angle?
No, nothing. Well, I discovered the last day people used to tease me. I discovered the diagonal, and the diagonal, I found it was a very liberating, dynamic experience. I used to carry my board, my drawing board, with me everywhere. You know, to the AA, because I pretended. I couldn't draw. And so I was locked up in a room on the top floor of the AA because I couldn't work at home. We had no studios at the AA.
The Architecture Association.
That's right. It's not Alcoholics Anonymous. So, you know, I didn't have all my instruments. No, I'm kidding. So I the nearest thing I can get to 90 degree was 89 degrees. So everything became so slightly out of focus, out of space. I have a famous line which people thought I made everybody in my office wear a T-shirt saying, there are 360 degrees, why should I use one? But I think it led to the discovery of many, not only the non-90 degrees, but the idea of the curve and the complex curve. It's not based on the circle or like the primitives or elliptical, but it's a fluid curve, and through computing also you can resolve all these issues, whether three multi kind of curvature surfaces and so on.
Let me take you back to your childhood. You grew up in Iraq, educated by Catholic nuns in Baghdad. You've traveled widely with your family and studied in Beirut and, of course, in London. I wonder if you could just reflect to what extent having that sort of upbringing actually inspired you in what you do now. How, you know, the kind of exposure to modernity when you were a child.
Well, I think that Iraq was very interesting in the 60s. I mean, it wasn't maybe, Iraq was one of many countries which were going through similar things, where it was about nation building, about identity. There was also tremendous interest at the time in that period in architecture, whether it's in Brazil or Africa or the Middle East or even Chicago. Chicago was built at that time, and all the skyscrapers at the time by SOM and all these people, and, you know, Brazil was, you know, the Brazilian experience was very interesting because it was a very conscious effort to dissociate from colonialism, and therefore they adopted modernity as a way of representing the state as well. So it was also about identity and about the building of the nation. And I suppose it happened to a degree also in the Arab world. There was an interest in architecture similar to this current moment. You know, and I think travel was, obviously I was very privileged to be able to travel through Europe every summer, but I can't really. So that is kind of the ideology of the family.
Talk about that, because I think that's interesting.
My father's influence on politics and vice versa. Of course, these things are impact on you.
Was it your mother or your father who encouraged you and made you feel that it was possible for you to become an architect?
And they both did. Yeah, I mean, and there was never a moment that I thought I could not become, not necessarily an architect, but anything. I did play with this idea for a while that I should become a psychiatrist. They both thought that would be a bad idea, since I was a nuts, even at a young age. Actually, psychiatry has helped me a lot. I'm very analytical, and I can suss people out. Of course, not everybody. I'm very good at it. I mean, close friends of mine like Brian Clark, they think, and others like Sam, who think I'm a witch. And I always say, I'm not a witch, I have a very acute sense of observation, and I can tell what they're up to. But nobody know, you know. So people who don't know me, they don't know that I'm Patrick, bless him. It took him 20 years to find out that I'm right about.
This is Patrick Schumacher sitting in the front row.
I would have gone into politics if I was not Iraqi. I knew that if I wanted to become a politician, that would be the end.
But your father was.
My father was a politician, and a very important one. And but, you know, my father always, I mean, I was curious because I witnessed a revolution when I was 7, 8 years old, and, you know, in Iraq. And a seven-year-old, you know, doesn't really understand what it is, but I did. I mean, I had to ask a question because everybody went around with slogans, you know, freedom, democracy, equality. And my father was very patient. He explained to me everything. My mother, on the other hand, wasn't patient. She just wanted me to leave her alone. Hence, I, much younger, she taught me how to draw because it was the only way I can be, I don't have to pester her all day long. Because I used to have a habit of walking behind them and asking them questions all day. I mean, that's how it was. I think the other thing, which is the fact I was in a nun school, was also very liberating. People don't realize that Catholic nuns are insane in the best possible way. And we had a headmistress who was very similar to Alvin Boyarsky in the sense they really believed in education. They really believed in education for women. And many of my contemporaries were scientists or doctors and engineers and so on. So that school was also very important.
Well, when it comes to architecture as an adult, what were your intellectual inspirations? Who did you turn to, who you were drawn to in your, say, 20s and 30s?
Well, I mean, Rem was a very important teacher.
Rem Koolhaas.
Yeah, Rem Koolhaas. And Ilya, they were both very important. Alvin Boyarsky was the AA chair of the Non-Alcoholics Anonymous, was an incredible educator. On one hand, I seemed a bit kind of wild. On the other hand, I was always very focused.
You're listening to Dream Builders on the BBC World Service. I'm Razia Iqbal, and I've been talking to Zaha Hadid about the inspiration behind her approach to architecture. Later, we'll be talking about the challenges Zaha has faced in reaching her exalted position and also the future of architecture. But now, could we have questions on what we've been discussing so far, the inspiration behind her individual and complex style?
Hello, Zaha. My name is Abid. I'm an architect working in Shoreditch. My question is, looking back at your previous work, such as the Vitra Fire Station and Cincinnati, Ohio Museum, and then looking to your more recent work, like the Guangzhou Opera House, do you think there's been a change, there's an evolution in what you're doing?
I hope there was progress, because if there was no progress for me in 30 years, it's a problem. No, I think that the shift from drawing, doing line, to 3D was a very, obviously, an incredible shift. And then the shift from drawing to building. Now, I always intended to build. The drawings we did, which were nobody understood, it was not for people to understand necessarily. I mean, I was punished, let's say, for the drawings. I think that shift, and with Vitra, when we moved from drawing to building, was the first, not break, but...
When you say you were punished, was that just because you felt that people didn't understand that the drawings could become buildings?
No, I don't think so. They just thought, well... And I, if you look at the projects, that period, I would draw it 5, 6 times. Every time it's slightly different. That was irritating to many people because they couldn't understand where it was. But it was... I mean, I would draw it once with the columns, one without the columns, one without the floors, to analyze every aspect of it. And people thought, oh, you know, buildings can't float. But I knew that there was like an irritation. I mean, they thought I lost the Cardiff Opera House because of the drawing, which is the most ridiculous thing possibly.
I'll ask you about Cardiff in a moment. Let's take some more questions.
So I think there are these moments when there are very conscious, let's say, changes.
The gentleman in the front.
Diane Sujic, Director of the Design Museum. Zaha, if you'd studied in America, how different would your work be now?
If I studied in America at the time, I mean, if I studied in America now, maybe not, but, well, it depends which school I went to. If I had gone to SIARC or Cooper, it would be one thing. If I had gone to Columbia at the time, or any of the other schools, I would have a very different Muslim career. The American schools, I don't know how they were. There was only, maybe Harvard was doing an option studio. They were very embedded into either the dogma of modernity, or they were into historicism. I mostly would become a, would have been maybe more successful business person if I was in, you know, more corporate architect.
But now you're both successful businesswoman and successful architect.
Well, you learn, but slowly. I would be more successful if I didn't have 200 men in my office blocking me.
Oh, tell us more.
No.
Go ahead, intervene immediately with your question.
Yes, actually, it's perfect. Sort of follows on. I'm interested, actually, in the beginning. What drove you forward at the beginning, when things were slightly difficult, maybe when you weren't winning competitions? What kept you? Were there any moments in time when you thought, this is too difficult? What kept driving you? That's ultimately what I'm interested in.
Well, I tell you, there were people who were around me who were very encouraging. Who worked with me in the office. And I think, well, you know, it was very dreary and very difficult. And I don't know why these kids would give up their nights out and hang out there. I mean, I am funny at times, but not that funny to amuse them all the time. And I think I was held by the fact that I had traveled. I've been to America and Brazil, and I've seen examples of work which were not the same, but they had a similar merit, and they were accomplished. And I really thought that that could be done. But it was at times quite difficult. But I think while doing the work, we also had a, we did have a great time. You know, I treasure these days. We had a belief that it would eventually come to something.
Okay, we're going to have two more opportunities to ask questions, but let's move on now. We talked about the Guangzhou Opera House earlier, and you now have several buildings here in the United Kingdom, the London Aquatic Centre, Glasgow Transport Museum, and a Maggie Centre in Kirkcaldy in Scotland. For a long time, though, you were known in this country for what's been described as a shocking and incomprehensible decision. It's been mentioned already. In 1994, your design for the Cardiff Bay Opera House won a competition against 267 other plans, but it brought controversy, and when the jury was disbanded and replaced, you were made to go through the process again, and you won a second time. Despite this, the Millennium Commission backed away, and the Opera House never got built. I want to ask you what you think was behind the fervent opposition in Cardiff.
Well, I mean, they just didn't like it.
But who are they? They did like it. You won the competition twice.
Well, I won the competition actually three times. When Diane is there, he knows more than I do what happened behind the scenes.
It's not behind the scenes, though. I mean, lots of people know what happened behind the scenes. What do you think was the reason? What was your perception of what it
well,
was that
they,
turned
they,
opinion?
The fact that I was in Iraq, he was absolutely a major problem. The fact I was a woman, that was a multi-problem, you know, and I couldn't change either. I mean, you know, they couldn't talk to me in Cardiff. You know, I mean, Doris Saatchi is sitting here, and she had a cabala of them whispering in an exhibition opening, and I don't want to name them, saying, don't worry, she will not do it, not on my dead body. And we know the gentleman, and
how do you account for that level of hostility?
Well, you know, what can you do? There is prejudice everywhere. The irony, of course, is that now the people go to Cardiff, they tell them, I've built the opera house. I mean, there's been so much going on about this opera house that actually the Welsh think I've built it. I swear to God, the American ambassador said, I went to see your building in Cardiff, and I said, it's not my building. He said, oh, they were telling me it's yours. I said, well, it's not.
It was a very significant moment, though, for you personally. It was your first major commission, and the rejection nearly sunk your practice entirely before you'd ever built anything in Britain. And I just want to ask you how you got through that, what it was that made you think, well, I'm either going to give up being an architect or I'm going to carry on.
I remember I knew, I was sure we would not get the funding for the Cardiff Opera House. And everybody said to me, oh, no, you're wrong. Don't worry. And when they rejected it, it was a disaster. That was maybe in December. I remember by spring, I made a conscious decision that I'm going to have to turn a page. I mean, everybody thought, oh, no, I'm finished. There are people here who've known me for years. But I made an absolute decision. When I was doing the competition for the V&A, which I knew I would not get because I was so stigmatized, and I am still, in a way, but I'm in a conscious decision that I cannot allow this to happen. I'm going to just carry on. I mean, it was 5 years. We did, I think, that period between 95 and 99, we did really fantastic work. We didn't win a single project.
I'm intrigued to hear you say that you are stigmatized still. I mean, you're now Dame Zaha Hadid, you've won the Sterling Prize twice, you're building in this country, you're building all over the world. In this country in particular...
There is something in the air.
You're among friends, Zaha, tell us.
I really don't know, it's just kind of... I walk around, there's kind of a shadow following me. I don't know, I feel that way.
How did you actually survive financially? Because it was a really, really low moment in terms of the practice.
Well, I think it was definitely through teaching and lecturing. And I mean, I was still being very demanded on the, let's say, lecture circuit. And in those days, London was not so crazily expensive. And it was very difficult. I mean, everyone who was in my office at the time would know that it was very tough.
I suspect that one of the things behind the lady's question over there earlier was to do with being a woman in a predominantly male profession. I mean, there are many women architects, perhaps not as many as many women would like, but there are very few working at the top, if any, apart from you. I want to ask you about that, because you seem to allude to that when you're talking about the shadow, when you talk about what
well,
people think about you.
I think that I'm sure that being a woman architect gave me many more advantages, but also a lot of disadvantages. I mean, you know, I can't go playing golf with the guys. I mean, you know...
Is that when the deals get done?
There is a kind of a brotherhood I cannot join. You know, I mean, whatever I do, no matter what I do, I'm not part of that universe, and maybe I don't want to be part of that world. On the other hand, I think that, you know, because, I mean, I don't know, I've not been a man, so I don't know if I would behave differently. I mean, they would definitely not talk about my clothes if I was a male, you know, or my nail polish or whatever, everybody's preoccupied, my color, hair. They're so preoccupied with my appearance. On the other hand, I think it kind of was rather, because, they did not know how to handle it, me, on one hand, I had a lot of freedom. I can do what I like. I didn't care. I don't care what I say. Some people think I'm intensely rude. And just because I'm not licking ass, excuse me. I'm not over. Oh, they think I'm rude because I am. People are so used to people being so over nice, you know. And if you not do that, you are rude. Or I am crazy. These things, they kind of privately upset me, but I didn't care, so I just carried on doing what I was doing. And that was very liberating. I didn't have to wear the gray suit and go to work and do certain things. So well, that was, I think, rather exciting.
Let me ask you about that, because it'll come as no surprise to you whatsoever that there are people who perceive you as a diva. You referred to people referring to you or seeing you as a witch.
I'm always called a diva.
Tell me whether
I've never called a guy a diva.
But let me ask you about that perception, because does it... when you talk about sometimes being a woman being an advantage, does being a diva help you get some things done, where if you behave differently, it may not?
Well, I'm not a diva, but... I don't know how softly
you say that. They
can't deal with it. They don't know whether a woman is called if she is very, has a strong personality or is opinionated, you know. And if you say the guy is pushy, it doesn't sound so bad. If you say a woman is pushy, it sounds much worse. If you say a woman is very ambitious, it sounds bad. If a guy is ambitious, it's great. He should be ambitious. So all these attributes men have, ambition, self-minded, you know, like totally blinkered, self-obsessed, blah, blah, is okay because that's how he should be. And the guy should be like that. But a woman, in the same way, if a guy throws themselves at you, he's not a slut. But if you're a woman doing that, you are the wrong thing. So, I mean, I think that, you know, and so I realized many years ago that whatever I do is going to be seen as sort of wrong. And I remember this very well in my second year or first year there. A classmate of mine, I came all dressed up there, and she said to me, "Zaha, you know, you should be really careful." I said, "Why?" She said, "Well, you look like a movie star, so you should not dress like that." I said, "What do I care?" And she said, "But, you know, they will really, you know, you'll pay a high price for it." And other people who were my teachers thought I looked like a movie star between rehearsals. But because they were not maybe accustomed to it, I mean, you know, there are, of course, camp men. But they also suffered. I mean, they don't like them for the same reason. So you have to always fit in within a particular mold in every way, not only the way you look or talk and also the way that the work you do. You have to fit in within a certain mold. And if you don't, it takes a long time for people to accept the fact that this is legitimate work.
Well, let's go back to the legitimate work. I want to ask you about the Evelyn Grace Academy in Brixton. It's quite different to your other work in terms of the purpose. It's a social building, it's a school. And I just want to ask you whether this is something that you are actively interested in pursuing. It's a new avenue for you, and whether it's something that you would like to do more of, as opposed to building signature buildings for museums or commercial functional buildings.
I would like to do social housing, actually, because I think it's... you know, or very mundane, people think, you know, I would not want to do corporate work or the offices, because I think that the majority, and especially, I mean, in the UK and in America, majority of work is, the landscape is really, is to do with corporate work, I mean, with the offices and so on. I'm curious about, you know, how one can interpret these things. And going into social housing, which you didn't call social housing anymore, it should not be the lowest denominator. It should be really very interesting. It could be non-expensive, but it could, because they occupy very important sites, and therefore you can't. And also, I think I do believe that the way to deal with society is not to remedy it after the catastrophe, but you have to prepare and give proper housing, good schools, good hospitals, and so on. These are very fundamental aspects of civic life. And I think every architect should be able to contribute in an interesting way, and they should not do them as the kind of cheapest possible way.
Is this something you've discussed with the United Kingdom government? I mean, is this something that you're interested in? Do you talk to politicians about
this? I'm going to call David Cameron and tell him, hello.
I think you should.
Yeah, well...
Well, let me ask you about the decision-making process for an architect at your level of success and fame. It must present new challenges, very different challenges, when you are involved in large commissions in countries where the political climate changes, or you're dealing with different people in charge. So what kind of calculation do you make as an architect who has been commissioned or has embarked on a project, say, in Libya, for instance, or in Egypt, anywhere where the political climate has shifted?
I am by nature kind of skeptical. On one hand, I'm optimistic, but I'm skeptical. I'm actually much more cautious than I look. Fortunately, with architecture, you absolutely cannot predict what's going to happen, whether economy or politics, or if it's a project for the state, then, you know, the president or the monarch, or you have no control what happens. I mean, who would have thought about when I was doing a project in Egypt that this is going to go wrong?
Fine, no, I accept that. But there's a difference between that and consciously making a choice to accept a commission, say, when Colonel Gaddafi was in power, or accept
a
commission.
Well, no, I mean, I think if somebody gives me a commission in Libya to do a parliament, I'll do it. I don't care who's in power, because I think if I can in any way contribute to a seat of democracy in any of these countries, I'll do them. Also, at the end of the day, it's not for the leadership, it's for the state. I mean, it's for the people in there. And I think that if I'm asked to do a Congress in Libya, I would do it.
But I'm not talking about post the Arab Spring in Libya. I'm talking about pre the Arab Spring.
Before. I mean, I'm an Arab. If I can contribute in any way to any of the countries in the Arab world with any project, I'll do it. Because I think any project in that part of the world will be an improvement.
Is there a difficulty, though, in dealing with political regimes that are not,
I'm casting a shadow over the whole world. Because then do I take a job in other places where they bomb people? What do I do about other countries who are quite legitimate, who do equal damage? How much censorship am I supposed to impose?
Well, it's a question I'm asking you about the calculations you make.
Yeah, I'm explaining.
I don't have to make those decisions.
I mean, maybe if Gaddafi asked me to do his house, I won't do it.
Well, he's no longer with us to make that relevant.
I don't know who else. I mean, would I do a house for George Bush when he was in power? But I think if one asked me to do a project like a parliament, where you can exist some level of democracy in that particular place, irrespective of the difficulty, I'll consider it.
Okay, well, you heard it here first. You're listening to Dream Builders on the BBC World Service. I'm Razia Iqbal, and I've been talking to Zaha Hadid about the inspiration behind her approach to architecture and the challenges she's had to face in achieving what she has. Later, we'll be talking about the future, and could we have questions now on what we've just been discussing, the challenges that Zaha Hadid has faced as an architect. Gentleman in the front.
Stuart Cameron, the Cass School of Architecture. You mentioned before that you have a certain cautious nature when you're faced with some projects, perhaps in parts of the world. Do you have any reservations about the two projects in the pipeline in your home country of Iraq?
No. I mean, as I said, as an Iraqi origin, but Iraqi, I mean, I personally think it's, the Arab world has not really made use of me very much. I think it's really a shame, and it's a great loss to me. Because I think I really thought that about 3-4 years ago, there was kind of a renaissance in the Arab world. They were beginning to build a lot of stuff, whether it's Dubai or Abu Dhabi or Qatar and Egypt, North Africa, Syria, Iraq. And I think especially North Africa is all, well, it might come back, but it's a moment of uncertainty, let's say. So, I mean, as an Arab, I think obviously differently about this and maybe other people, because I feel whatever contribution I can make to that part of the world is very important, because that region was incredibly wealthy and that work should connect to other work to become part of the architecture world, not just dealing with regional stuff, that they had to kind of, it has to be elevated to another level, and I think they have the potential, and therefore any example, as I said, I have been asked to do funny things, but I had refused them, but not when it's a building which benefits people in general.
Any more questions?
Hi, it's Rory Aljaito, the Architects Journal. I just wanted to ask you a question about your partner, Patrick Schumacher, actually. He's done much to popularise parametricism, which is the mode of expression you have become famous for. I wonder, do you think Hadid Schumacher Architects as a name for your practice would better reflect the creative forces of the practice?
I don't mind putting his name there.
He's got a big
smile on
his face.
Name there. He has to commit himself first.
Why don't you explain to people, particularly our radio audience, what parametricism means to you?
I think Patrick should explain it. He's the king of parametricism. Can you get him the microphone?
But you're associated with it too, so you have.
I'm not. He's a parametric guy.
Patrick, you're being given the microphone. Patrick Schumacher.
I think this is a movement in architecture which transcends Zadid Architects and what we are doing. It's something which encompasses a whole generation of architects globally, not only in Europe, but also in the USA, Latin America, the Middle East, and a lot in Asia. And here the idea is that after, I would say, about 25 years of searching a new viable paradigm to impact the built environment globally, similarly to what modernism achieved in the 20th century over 50, 60 years, and went into crisis in the kind of 70s, and ever since we've gone through a number of attempts to develop a new agenda and paradigm through postmodernism, deconstructivism, then going back to kind of a retro modernism in the name of minimalism. We finally found, I guess, well, that's what I believe anyway, and many young architects believe, a new way forward, which gives architecture a much more developed repertoire of versatility, malleability, adaptability, give much more differentiation and complexity to the built environment, but in a way which is not just the kind of chaos of collage and the absence of order, but a new kind of more sophisticated and elaborate order. And I define sometimes parametricism with the phrase that all elements of architecture have become parametrically malleable. So every component and element has variables, and therefore a multiplicity of shapes the elements can take, and in concert they become continuously differentiated system which kind of can pick up complex contexts and can modulate scenarios rather than repeating. So it's something which is very much also learned from complexity theory and in fact chaos theory, the way the sciences have been showing us how to understand, break down and simulate and recreate the complexities of nature. And that's what was advanced intuitively in Zaha's work early on, which I think matches this new society we now are living in, which I call post-Fordist network society.
Zaha, since this is your show, I have to give you the last word about parametricism.
No, I think Patrick said everything. We actually rehearsed this in the car. I said, I'll get you to talk, but don't talk too long.
There'll be one last opportunity to ask questions, but let's move on. Let's talk about Iraq now, Zaha, and your role in rebuilding, or at least being commissioned to make the signature building for the Bank of Iraq in Baghdad, and you're waiting to hear about the Iraqi parliament. What sort of future do you hope for your country? And do you think you can incorporate elements of what you hope into your design for at least the Bank of Iraq building?
Well, I don't know. I think that region is very difficult unless you really are a clairvoyant. You don't know what's going to happen. I'm sure there's tremendous potential in all these countries because, I mean, Iraq, they have to start from almost from blank piece of paper. So that could be rather exciting, but I haven't been in so many years, I can't say.
You haven't been since you were 17?
No, I've not been since I was 30, but I haven't been recently.
What does it mean to you to have been asked to do that building?
Oh, I think it's very nice. Well, I mean, I think it's particularly because this was not a competition. They asked us really to do they commissioned us to do the bank. And I suppose it's as symbolic to them as it is symbolic to me.
Tell me about...
And particularly, you know, my father was Minister of Finance, so there was a big involvement with him and the central bank.
When you talk about the potential for the region, is there a desire in you to be involved much more in the rebuilding of Iraq, given how devastated it has been?
I'm sure if I... but I don't know. I mean, I don't know the time scale. You know, I don't know. I cannot easily go back and forth to Iraq, so I cannot kind of offer my services willy-nilly. I mean, as I said, you know, I think that in these kind of situations, you can do something kind of very radical, whether it's in Baghdad and other cities. I mean, every city, they have commissioned people to do master plans and so on. I mean, there is a kind of course, maybe a desire to do things in the sense that they are kind of not necessarily Arabesque, but let's say regional.
When you talk about being an Arab in the world of architecture, to what extent is being an Arab inform your work? Because people have talked about the influence of calligraphy. I want to ask you about whether there's something about the landscape of Iraq that informs your vision in any way.
I really don't know. I'm sure there is something. I think it's more to do with the geometry, actually. Geometry and math, and maybe the fluidity of the landscape, or, you know, if everybody wants to kind of really analyze everything everybody does, yeah, the calligraphy, the seamless lines, the funny curve, the dunes, I mean, you can find all sorts of things. But I mean, my upbringing really was not very traditional at all. You know, as I said, I went to French nun school. We did can-can as students, you know, tried to play piano. I mean, everything my parents wanted me to be, I failed miserably. A ballerina, a pianist. I sadly have never learned to do any of the prayers or anything, because I crossed my heart for 5 years till I discovered I'm not a Christian. And I decided that I should not do it anymore. And I complained. And my mother said, well, you really don't have to do it. And of course, the nuns went bananas. You know, my brothers were both at university in the UK and at Cambridge. My father studied at LSC in the 20s. So it was not really a very kind of traditional kind of, we spoke Arabic. So I wasn't very traditional in that sense. So,
okay, well, let's
the only thing which I was inspiring me in Iraq was really the rivers, you know. I mean, I like water to this day. I think the rivers and the Tigris and the Euphrates, these are, for me, I think, have a tremendous influence on me, and the palm trees and so on.
Let's talk about the future. The New York Times has said of your work that it's as close to a manifesto for the future as we have, citing buildings like the Maxi Center for the 21st century culture in Rome. They seem to offer people a different experience of what architecture can be. Do you think that you're no longer a lone voice, and that you that architecture and your ideas is kind of that it's going your way now?
Well, I think that I was in Berlin when Christo wrapped the Ragtat. And it was a very weird event. But everybody celebrated that event because it was such a strange moment. And I realized then that people are people always said here, oh, we should only give people what they want, between brackets. And I realized people actually want something else. People want to, now, not everybody in the world, I've always said this, can travel everywhere. And so I think it's very important that you have people, that you have something which is in your locale that you can go to. So that I think people also, ambitions have changed. They want to experience something else. Whether it's in a museum, or it's in a house, or it's in a concert hall. So I think that changed. I think there is the kind of the elitist idea that, you know, everything, whether it's opera or art, is elitist, that it's not open to the general mass. It's also changed. People feel more free to go to these happenings or events, whether it's the Tate or the Freeze or whatever. I think there is, the curtain has kind of lifted, and therefore, or the stigma or whatever, it has lifted. So I think that the work we were doing coincided with the time when people want to have a different experience. It's not just experiencing an art object in a museum, but experience in the space. And I think that's a very exciting idea, that people want to go to experience space, because space is not quantifiable. You can't, you know, I mean, the same way they went to churches, but they're not many always religious. So they want to visit, they want to experience something else, and I think that's what's happening.
What you seem to be suggesting is a paradigm shift in people's attitudes to buildings.
Well, there was a paradigm shift. I mean, that's not a kind of a general, but I think that, yeah, I think that people want a better environment, and they should have it, you know. They want a better environment, whether it's on the level of an interior, or the level of a shopping center, or the level of an airport, or whatever. People's expectations are higher. Their tastes are more, is different. You know, I'm not talking about ugliness versus beauty only, but I think that there's a lot of visual stuff. You know, there's a lot of magazine, there's nothing on the internet, there's television. People are kind of not oversaturated, but they can judge, they are more critical about what they see.
So what's next for you now? You've achieved so much in a very, very short, very incredibly busy space of time. Just tell us what's on the cards for you now.
Well, this coming year, in terms of buildings finishing, there are quite a few will finish this year, which is the one in Beijing, the Galaxy Soho. Then, and a museum in Michigan. I mean, the one in Beijing is really an interpretation of what a large block should be, you know. Instead of a tower, you break the mass into kind of a series of buildings, let's say. Then Michigan, then Baku, the ferry terminal in Italy, which has been massaged for 10 years. Italy, they do very nice stuff, but it's very slow. And then the tower for a school in Hong Kong. And we have quite a few things on the table. I mean, a lot of work in China, and also we always try to do competitions, because I like doing competitions only because through them we developed ideas. And I think it's a difficult system, but it's still fair enough. And we don't win every competition, but it's our way of doing things. And also, for us, it's been a great learning experience, because through it we can also test certain ideas or invent certain ideas.
Tell me what your artistic ambitions are for architecture now, because you're moving into lots of different fields. It's not just about buildings for you anymore.
Well, I still think that we haven't... I mean, I still think it would be interesting to see how one can do a very large site. I mean, not one single site, but maybe a series of sites. Yeah. I've never done a house. I'm doing one now. But I think it's fundamental.
For yourself or for a client?
No, for myself. Never.
Why ever not?
It's a very long story. I will never get anybody in my office to work in my house. You know, it's like, you know, make sure you catch them there like a fish and they disappear there. You know, and if I leave it to Patrick, I'll never have a house. You know, so... no. But I still think there's a lot of work. I mean, there's still a lot of, let's say, projects. One has not large master plans. You know, this convention between urbanism and architecture and master planning, because they're not separated anymore. There's like one, you know, they can be combined.
I'm intrigued that you don't want to build a house for yourself.
No, I would love to, but honestly, I'm also kind of practical.
Okay. I was just wondering whether you could not tolerate yourself as your client.
No. I would like to do my own house. But I have to have people work on it, and they won't do it. I mean, I have to hire a separate office.
You're listening to Dream Builders on the BBC World Service. I'm Razia Iqbal, and I've been talking to Zaha Hadid about the inspiration behind her approach to architecture and the challenges she has had to face and the future for architecture itself. A final opportunity for questions now. The gentleman here.
Zaha, it's Hanif Kara. I'm a structural engineer. I'm not sure whether you get how much you've inspired the people who make a lot of your buildings. I overheard the mayor recently talking about it in a very nice way, let's say.
The mayor of London, Boris Johnson.
Yes, the mayor of London, yes. If you had a two-minute interview with him or a discussion with him, what advice would you give him for what he's going to do at the Olympic site? At the Olympic site.
I think there's a lot to do here. There are some enormous sites being developed in London, and I don't want to say they're all bad, but we know that 70% of the time they're terrible. But there are very, very large developments, and I think that they should give the chance, to other officers. It is a bit of a monopoly here. And I think it needs to be opened up and also not be scared because everything's in London, you can't build anything weird here. But actually, that weird work came out of London, Well, not just us. Many of these ideas which developed in the last 30 years is really an outcome of being part of the AA and being part of the English situation. So it's a very curious that these things don't have a presence here.
In the front.
Lucien Smith.
He was my PA.
That's right. Former employee of Zaha, a friend, I hope. We've heard a lot this evening about people that have inspired you over the years. And how do you feel now that you are an inspiration to others? And was there a particular moment when you noticed first that you had inspired someone, perhaps in buildings or other ways?
It's very nice. I never realized it till maybe, 15 years ago, when Peter Eisenman told me that, Zaha, do you realize you are, a role model for a lot of women architects? And I didn't really, take him terribly seriously. I can't say. I don't know. I think it's very nice. People coming out to me and undressing and telling them to sun their backs or whatever they do to me. All these good-looking men.
Extraordinary effect you have on people. Well, sadly, we have now run out of time, and that's a great note to on which to end. My thanks to all of you for coming and to our hosts, the Royal Institute of British Architects in London. And last but not least, my thanks to Zaha Hadid, an extraordinary architect who I'm certain 50, 100 years from now will be seen to have had a profound influence, not just on our landscape, but on how we think about architecture. Zaha Hadid, thank you very much indeed. Thank you.